Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
This is Radio at Firehouse.com. Through the Smoke, I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Welcome. Now, look, we have a new producer this week, so if there's problems, it's probably not your computer. We welcome Matt Evans, our new producer of the show. Erica Smith, our previous producer, couldn't handle stress, and he went to work for the federal government. And our producer as well, we have actually Pete Matthews as well from Firehouse.com. Most of you know Pete, working with Matt and helping us get the show out, and we appreciate it. And again, we thank everybody for the incredible listenership on Through the Smoke. We're actually blown away at the interest on this show. A couple comments and a few items in the news before we get on this week's show. Actually, a personal one first, because we do have a lot to cover with you this week. I didn't see any of you in Las Vegas for the Firehouse show because I wasn't there. Some of you may know, Terry, my wife, her dad, took a pretty difficult health turn here lately, and we've been dealing with that, so I was unable to come out there. I hear the show was good, and it was good to hear the feedback and control the comments, but we'll see at the next show that we're all at together. On this week's show, I got two guests. Our primary guest is Mike Galliano. Really, you know, across the nation, firefighters are waking up to the reality that we can no longer treat our air as an afterthought, meaning our SCBA air. Numerous line-of-duty deaths, serious injuries, and close calls are the grim reminder that running out of air in a hazard area is a risk that cannot be taken. I mean, every firefighter who's ever taken SCBA training who's crawled through a building with smoke conditions is just, you always have in the back of your mind, I hope this SCBA works well and I hope I get out of here. And, you know, there's a group of firefighters out there who we've seen at some of the various shows around the country called the Seattle Guys. And Captain Mike Galliano was amongst that group, and Mike's a captain with the Seattle, Washington Fire Department, assigned Engine 32 and a member of the Fire Department's Operational Skills Enhancement Development Team, whatever the hell that means. We'll have to find out later. And he's had 19 years of fire crash rescue experience with the Fire Department and the United States Air Force, and he instructs nationally on the topic of air management, meaning your SCBA air management. And I'm really excited to have Mike join us this week on the show. You know, they say whether firefighters get lost, have buildings collapse on them, or we have to overextend ourselves, running out of air is the cause of our demise in so many cases. Using basic firefighting techniques like rope-assisted search, oriented search, inch and three-quarter and two-and-a-half hose deployment, he's going to talk to us about learning to manage our air effectively. And I said we're going to talk with Mike this week about the rule of air management as far as how it relates to the point of no return and how he can help us make these decisions as we're calling down some hallway in our SCBA. This somewhat new skill is in firefighter safety, talking about managing our air, has proven to improve situational awareness so we can maximize our time in the hazard area and maintaining that margin of safety so we can get out. How do we recognize the point of no return? Mike's going to talk about that with us this morning on the show, and I hope it's going to be a real value to you. You know, rapid intervention techniques are vital to the fire ground. We saw that twice this week, and I'm going to talk about the two incidents where we did see where rapid intervention teams did work. But the Seattle Guys and Mike representing them would rather assist you in preventing situations where firefighters are in need of RIT assistance as opposed to you needing a RIT team to pull you out of there if it works successfully. The Seattle Guys and their Managing Your Air program use the term prevention before intervention, and they're going to teach us some stuff as we talk a little bit later, how to recognize and prevent situations in which we will end up calling the Mayday and hoping the RIT team can save our tails before we run out of air. So, Mike, welcome to the show. You out there?
I'm out there. Hey, thanks very much. It's a privilege to be part today.
Well, we appreciate you. If you just kick back, relax, and spend a few minutes with us this morning, it'll be great. I also have with us this week Danielle Kagan from Fireman's Fund Insurance, and it's going to be just a quick interview with Danielle. But as you probably know by now, the Fireman's Fund is hosting and has put together a very cool movie called Into the Fire that's going to be on this Friday, or if you're listening to the show after Friday, then you've already seen the show, hopefully. but it's going to be on this Friday, October 13th at 8 p.m., 7 Central, and Sunday, October 22nd at 4 p.m., and that's 3 p.m. Central. And that really is an extension of the Very Cool Fireman's Fund Heritage Program, which has awarded millions of dollars to fire departments each year. And by the way, if your fire department has not gotten your Fireman's Fund grant, you need to click the link down below here on the website and get information on the grant. It's free money. Fireman's Fund Insurance also conceived an idea and funded this film. Funds raised through showing of the film and the DVD sales. Yep, you'll be able to buy a copy of this to add to your fire collection of fire videos and what have you. In 2007, it's going to be used to purchase firefighting equipment like thermal imagers for fire departments nationwide in association with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. So we're going to talk to Danielle in just a couple of minutes, but first I want to talk to you about some current events and some news-related items. Just a quick mention about some friends of mine in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Many of them in the area are fans of the show, and I love hearing from them and visit with them when we're out in that area in particular. And many of you may not know that in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, many of the fire companies have Amish firefighters, and they are some of the best and most aggressive firefighters I've ever met. And they're really not all that different than you and I, other than their lifestyle. Very tragically, last week, we all read and watched on TV the absolutely insane, tragic shootings of those children in the one-room schoolhouse in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, in particular in Bart Township. Those murders of those little girls directly impacted and devastated many of those firefighters. As a matter of fact, if you can even conceive this, every firefighter in that fire company, whether Amish or non-Amish, knew every child that got, knew their families, knew the shooter, knew the shooter's families. So talk about devastation in a response. Absolutely unbelievable. And I had the opportunity last week to spend a day and a half down there with some of the responders. I had an opportunity to meet with the Amish bishop for that area, who's now I consider a friend of mine, John, who represents the community. I spent time talking with the chief, the assistant chief, and the members of the Bart Township Fire Department. And, you know, when we respond to a call, the last thing we ever want to do is encounter a loved one. Truly, it's a worst-case scenario. And that's what almost all of them went through last week when they responded in there. They knew those kids. So keep them in your thoughts and prayers as they deal with this situation. And keep in mind that that could be any of us. That's one of those there, but for the grace of God, go I situations. If you'd like to express your condolences or check them out, I have a link right here on the website, right down below where you were listening to the show. Check it out. Go to their website. Look at the fire company. And maybe put an entry in their guest book and just let them know you're out there thinking about it. So again, our thoughts and prayers out to our friends in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, the dispatchers, the EMA people, the state police, the EMS respondent, in particular, the members of the Bart Township Fire Company. New subject. Hallelujah. The Department of Homeland Security has released the Fire Act grants. We couldn't be more proud. It only took them 6 months to get it done this year. A 6 month delay. Not that it has anything to do with politics. I'm sure it has nothing to do with that. But we're glad that finally the grants have been released. We're going to keep an eye on that, and I know others are well. We need this money now. Now, you know, you can go back and forth on whether or not the federal government ought to be giving fire departments money. So a lot of people feel very strongly that they shouldn't, that if a community fire department needs funding, it should be coming from the community. Well, guess what? It's not. So there's got to be a better solution. And fortunately, some good folks in Washington, a couple years ago, elected good folks, by the way, came up with the Fire Act grant program. And now they've been released. The grants are flowing. The money's coming out. The fact of the matter is we need the funding. There are fire departments in this country that barely get by. I was amazed, for example, when I talked to my friends in Bart Township. They've got a quick modern fire company. Their budget is next to nothing. They're still doing dinners and sales and boot drives to raise money. That's absolutely incredible. And personally, my opinion is fire departments shouldn't have to do that in this day and age, but it's a fact, and that's how they operate. But again, thank you to the Department of Homeland Security for getting off their asses and finally getting our Fire Act grants out there. This money is needed desperately for fire companies to continue and move forward. So anyway, last weekend in Emmitsburg was again the 25th National Fallen Firefighters Memorial Weekend in Emmitsburg. And just a congratulations to Ron Sarnicky and the staff at the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, the staff at the United States Fire Administration, the National Fire Academy, Dennis O'Neill, Charlie Dickinson, all those great folks for helping put together an absolutely fantastic weekend, considering it's such a sad situation. The families of nearly 107 fallen firefighters joined us in Emmitsburg this weekend for a number of very important events, including some counseling sessions, some training sessions to help the families move forward, and of course the candlelight service Saturday evening, as well as the absolute beautiful memorial service that went on Sunday. So again, thanks to all the families that attended, thanks to all the escorts, all the volunteers that make the weekend so successful, and especially our hearts go out to the families of those firefighters who lost their lives in the line of duty. In Baltimore City this week, a firefighter was killed and two others were injured in a tragic two-alarm blaze. We mourn the death of firefighter Alan M. Roberts, who had 19 years on the job with Baltimore City Fire Department. Reports are that he leaves a wife and two kids behind. The fire occurred around 2:30 a.m. in a row house. Occupants were jumping out of the building when the fire companies arrived. They had heavy fire and smoke coming from the two-story brick row home upon arrival. The firefighters were operating inside. There was a partial collapse of the second floor. The rapid intervention team rescued them within minutes. One of the firefighters, the surviving firefighters, has serious injuries, and the others have minor burns. And again, our hearts go out to the family of Alan Roberts, as well as all of the Baltimore City firefighters, in what is clearly a tragic event. They have not lost a firefighter in the line of duty in 11 years, which is really impressive considering the amount of activity they have and the amount of population that they protect in Baltimore City. So watch firehouse.com for information regarding the funeral for firefighter Roberts. Another tragic event this week, while not a loss, but in Nebraska, a firefighter was burned while operating in a cornfield fire. Now, you laugh at that, and you think, you know, well, how bad can it be? Well, obviously, something went wrong. They're not exactly sure what happened out there, but they were operating in this working cornfield fire, which required 10 different fire departments to assist. And a firefighter is now suffering second and third degree burns. That's Donovan, Nebraska firefighter Jim Schaefer, who got caught and was obviously trapped and burned in that cornfield fire. And we wish him the best for a quick recovery, and all the Donovan area firefighters that were affected by that particular fire. And again, this past week, another vehicle-related incident in southwest Travis County, Texas. A Marble Falls area EMS ambulance crashed with a pickup truck this week, and the cops say the pickup truck lost control on wet roads and slid sideways around 5 o'clock in the morning during a rainstorm and T-boned the ambulance and the truck. So the driver of the pickup truck died, and one of the paramedics died as well, and another paramedic is in critical condition. Just goes to show you got to watch all the time for these people out on the roads. These folks in the MS unit were just doing their jobs, and this guy's going too fast or something. He loses control, hits him, kills one, kills himself, and critically injures a paramedic. And another fire-related incident out in Apple Valley Fire Protection District in California. Two firefighters from Apple Valley suffered second and third degree burns last Monday when they were operating at a house fire. Just like in the tragic line of duty death in Baltimore this week, a trained RIT team got the firefighters out, as they did also both in Baltimore and Apple Valley. You know, a lot of fire departments still don't call RIT teams, or only if we need them. It's my opinion that on your first alarm assignment, a company needs to be assigned as a RIT team, and that shouldn't be a firefighting company. That should be an extra company to what would normally be your first alarm. Some people say, we're putting that equipment on the road for no reason. Well, if somebody calls up and says their building's on fire, that's enough reason for me. If you're going, you should have a RIT team operating on the scene, protecting and taking care of your personnel as well. You just never know when something might go wrong. So, our hearts and prayers go out to those affected, in particular right now, the Apple Valley firefighters, for a quick improvement on their burns and injuries. Well, you know what? Elections are coming up. locally one guide for you to for you as a firefighter on who to select is easy from a firefighting standpoint. How have they supported you and your fire department? To me, it's real simple, easy, and is no nonsense. Either you've supported us in the last couple of years or you haven't. How did you vote Fire Act funding? How did you work locally as far as supporting our fire department? Did you support additional funding for staffing? Did you support recruitment and retention issues? Very, very simple for firefighters to decide whether or not we're going to elect you. You know who supports your fire department and who doesn't. Again, where are they on funding, staffing, training, and related needs that relate directly to the public getting your help when they call? Forget all the words and all the other, quote, we love our firefighters crap that they say to us years, you know, all year or year long. But now in particular, this time of year, as election day creeps up, when they suddenly start showing up at your firehouse. Vote for those who have supported firefighters from the moment they were elected and never forget who those people are. But the issue I want to talk to you about right now real quick, it really affects you no matter where you're a firefighter. And this is about Kurt Weldon, who's been our firefighter and the fire chief in Congress for probably 20-something years now. Yeah, about 20 years. Kurt Weldon is in a major race, and he's being heavily challenged with loads of cash behind the attempt to seat him in his district there in Pennsylvania. Now, why does this matter to me or you? Well, because for the last 20 years, there's really been a firefighter on the Hill looking out for all of us. Volunteer, career paid, part paid, poorly paid, I don't care what you are, Kurt Weldon always looked out for firefighters. And now in 2006, it is still very clear that Kurt has never forgotten his beginnings and his dedication for the nation's firefighters and the fire service. And not once has he ever wavered in those years in support of firefighters. Of course, the proof is in the pudding. Now, we're not getting paid for this. This is not an ad. This is strictly my opinion. And I first met Kurt in the formation of gatherings of the Congressional Fire Services Caucus back in 1987. Today, the Congressional Fire Services Caucus is the largest caucus with over 340 members of Congress looking out for firefighters. Founded by Kurt Weldon in 87, the caucus unites Republicans and Democrats in support of the fire service legislation that benefits every one of us. But without Kurt Weldon, none of this would have happened. Kurt has been a major, or the major, player when it comes to fire stuff in every bit of national fire-related legislation from the first day he was elected to office. And without Kurt in Congress, we're in great danger of losing the recognition and status the fire service currently has on the Hill. Now, some of you say we don't have all that much status. Well, what would it be like if we didn't have Kurt Weldon? And honestly, we need to elect more Kurt Weldons in there. But right now, we are in danger of losing our best and possibly the most powerful supporter, our firefighter in Congress, Kurt Weldon. So how can you help? Well, if you live in his district, vote for him. But for the rest of us, they still need our help. So take a few seconds and check the link I've got down here on the site, www.firefighterforweldon.com, and do what you can. This is a big deal. There are no other federally elected officials that represent and have the history of looking out for firefighters more than Kurt Weldon. As you know, he's a former chief officer and former firefighter in Pennsylvania. Kurt clearly sets the example as far as what representatives should do to take care of firefighters. And he's made a major difference to all American firefighters countless times. So check out the website. You know, as firefighters, we have a long history of taking care of one another. Consider how Kurt Weldon has taken care of us for the past 20 years, and now it's time for a little bit of payback. There's a new show coming out that we're going to be watching on TV this week, or if you're listening to the show, it'll be you've already seen it, and that's Into the Fire. It's going to be on the History Channel, as I said earlier, October 13th at 8 p.m., and Sunday, October 22nd. And the information on the show is on the link below here. And again, it's a very cool extension of their support. They've put this video, this movie, it's a movie about firefighters. I think you're going to love it. I've seen the preview. I loved it. I thought it was very well represented. They did a good job in balancing the very different types of fire departments and firefighters we have out there. So make sure you watch it. Set your recorders, DVRs, TiVos, whatever else you have to check out this excellent documentary. Matter of fact, right now, one of my guests today is Danielle Kagan from Fireman's Fund. So we're going to come back in just a second, talk with Danielle for just a few minutes about the movie, what Fireman's Fund is doing to help us, what we can do to get money from them, and then after that we're going to spend some time talking about breathing air as firefighters. We'll be right back. You're listening to Through the Smoke at RadioFirehouse.com. This is Billy Goldfeder.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
Hey, we're back. This is Through the Smoke on Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We're going to get to the discussions of SCBAs and smoke and air management in just a little while, but first I've got a friend of mine and a good, very special guest on to tell you all about a movie that if you're listening to this show on Thursday or Friday, the movie's on Friday night or Sunday, and if you're listening to the show past then you've already probably seen the movie, but we're looking at a movie called Into the Fire. That's been pretty heavily advertised throughout the fire service community. The entire project was hosted, funded, and sponsored by Fireman's Fund, and I've got Danielle Kagan, who is pretty much our link to Fireman's Fund in the fire service, and we've seen Danielle probably around for the last, about a year and a half or 2 years now at the fire service shows and what have you. So welcome, Danielle.
Thank you, Chief.
How long have we seen you?
It's been almost 2 years.
2 years, right. Wow.
And the program, Fireman's Fund, was actually started its Fireman's Fund Heritage Program about 2.5 years ago. It was the spring of 2004, and shortly thereafter, I joined the company.
Okay, now, Fireman's, let's talk about that, then we'll get into the movie. But my impression is, and literally out of nowhere, I was at some meetings, different boards and committees I'm involved in, and Daryl Seary, your boss, and or who basically started the liaison with the fire service, comes to a meeting, and the impression I got is one day somebody was walking around firemen, and they opened up a filing cabinet and said, "Oh, look at this file." They opened up the file and said, "Oops, we're supposed to be helping the fire service," and under that folder was a whole lot of money, because I guess I don't know what's going on, but you guys are doing a great job. And how much money have you given away? Or how much has Fireman's Fund given away in the last 2 years?
We've awarded more than $8 million in grants to National Fire Service organizations and local fire departments.
Unbelievable. Now, let's talk about it. What happened? Why suddenly now?
Well, the company was founded in 1863 in San Francisco with a mission to support the fire service. And in fact, at the time, all fire departments were volunteer, and a number of our members of our board, our organization, were required to be volunteer firefighters. And you know, for those that are fire service buff, know that the insurance industry and the fire service were very closely tied in their origins. So we started that with that mission, and a few years ago, as the company was undergoing a transition, we were looking at how do we market ourselves, how do we brand ourselves, what do we want to be known as. And I joke around, you know, do we get a duck, do we get a gecko? What do we want to be known as an insurance company? And the idea came out, well, why don't we return to our founding mission? It was right around the time of the Cedar Fires down in San Diego. And the chief down there, Chief Bowman at the time, said in the papers that we don't have the equipment we need to fight these fires.
Right.
And that was an eye-opening experience for the company. We looked at that and said, hey, maybe that's something that we should do. Maybe we should return to our founding mission, which we've supported fire service things throughout our history, but you know, we expanded to do other things. And so now we're back to our roots and aggressively awarding grants to fire departments.
I mean, $8 or $9 million is one hell of a lot of money, and what you guys are doing, talk about put your money where your mouth is, or talking about giving back. We hear so many organizations talk about giving back, and when you look into what they're giving back, it's nothing. And to me, you know, the kind of money that you guys have been giving back to the fire service, fantastic. I know you sponsored fire prevention programs. I know fire departments have purchased thermal image equipment. traffic control equipment, all stuff related, directly related to firefighter safety and survival. Probably, I guess, the two biggest projects you've sponsored is the IFF National Firefighter Near Miss Reporting System, as well as the National Firefighters Firefighter Survival Program as well. Is that correct? Those two,
that's
the two
right.
biggest
we
ones?
Funded those two. Those are our largest programs, and we
everybody goes home is what I was trying to think of, right?
We provided the full matching grants combined over $1 million between those two programs. So that those organizations could then focus on implementing the program instead of trying to raise those matching funds.
Unbelievable. Now, fire departments who are interested in applying for grants can click on our link, or you can just go to firemansfund.com, and you'll see a link there to the Fireman's Fund Heritage Program, correct?
Yes, and the way our grants are awarded currently is they're awarded agents and through our employees. So any employee of the company is able to nominate a fire department for a grant, and our agents are able to direct grants based on the growth of their business. So it's our way as well of giving back in the communities where we're growing.
That's outstanding. So basically, they go to your website, the information's there, they can contact their local agent and work on an application for a grant in that manner.
Exactly. You can do that, and we also have a survey on our website. That it's not a traditional grant program that you actually apply, but you fill out a survey, and that way we've got the needs and the fire department contact information captured. And as we have agents and employees that are interested in directing grants, we forward that information on to them.
Very cool. All right, so then one day you guys are sitting around or hanging around the water cooler and say, wow, we found more money. Let's do a movie. Now you got now I was privileged to see into the – where did I see it? Baltimore, I think.
Yeah.
I saw the – the preview in the Baltimore Firehouse Expo, and I thought it was great. I really was. Understand, I like anything that has anything to do with the fire service, where a lot of people will be critical of some movies. I think it's great. The more exposure, the better. But quite honestly, this really took it to a higher level as far as I was concerned. You look at the career fire service, you look at the volunteer fire service, you look at metro cities, you look at rural, you look at pretty much everything in the fire service, and the guy who put this movie together, talk about Bill.
Well, his name is Bill Couturier, and Fireman's Fund came up with the idea of creating Into Fire as a way to help educate the public about the needs of fire departments. Because, frankly, most people in the public think fire departments have everything they need. And so this was a way of expanding our Fireman's Fund Heritage Program. So when we thought about the idea, we were looking for a director that could bring our vision of you know, educating the public to the screen, and we immediately thought of Bill Couturier. He's done a variety of movies, documentaries generally, and they're focused on really bringing to life people's stories. And so he went around the country.
Bill also, it should be noted that he has done some work with the soldiers over in Iraq.
Yeah.
And also
yeah.
soldiers in Vietnam. So now he's doing another group of soldiers, firefighters.
That's right. And his fascination is what makes people, people do things or sacrifice themselves for others. And so he has done work with the military, and then when it came time for this opportunity, he's like, well, of course, that's a no-brainer. It's the fire service. Why didn't I think that sooner? So he went to task and talked to leaders in the fire service, got to know the fire service, and went across the country, met with, as you had mentioned, Chief, he met with volunteer, career, wildland, urban, rural, EMS folks, and just listened to their stories, and then put those all together in a 70-minute movie. It's going to be longer on the History Channel because of commercials, of course.
Right.
But the response that we've been getting as we've been showing it at the fire service trade shows has been overwhelmingly positive for the fire from the fire service. And one of the things that has been very emotional for me is that people coming out saying, "Gosh, finally somebody got it right."
Yeah, well, and that's true. It really does hit the nail on the head. It's not a drama movie like Ladder 49 or Backdraft. It's not designed to be entertaining, but it certainly is entertaining. There's characters in the movie that every one of us will identify with. Oh, that firefighter there, that clown's just like Joe in my department or Mary on his department, that kind of thing. So I think there's going to be a connection there that we're all going to feel. The movie is being shown this Friday, October 13th, 8 p.m. on the History Channel. And then again, am I seeing October 22nd as well?
That's right, 4 p.m., 3 p.m. Central.
Okay, so not this coming Sunday, but the following Sunday then.
Correct.
Okay, October 13th, 8 p.m., or October 22nd, 4 p.m., or just set your TiVo, your DVR, or VCR, whatever it is, and get this recorded. Now, will fire departments be able to get copies of this to be used within their local communities to show their politicians? I mean, they can record it on the History Channel and get it that way, but will DVDs be available as well?
Yes, absolutely. In 2007, the DVDs will be available. We'll be announcing that through our website and through our email list. So if people go into and see the Fireman's Fund Heritage Program, sign up for our e-newsletter, we'll be announcing those plans. What the other piece of this is that the film is going to be used to raise funds for the fire service. So there will be a call to action. We've partnered with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation to help provide a mechanism to raise funds through this film and the DVD sales as well. So we're encouraging fire departments to look at how they can use this film, either showing their local elected officials, helping to recruit volunteers, helping to recruit career firefighters. There's all sorts of opportunities there, and we'll be exploring those in great detail in the coming weeks.
So Fireman's Fund, and again, gang, I remind you on this show, no one we're talking to is paying for this. This isn't free advertising. This is how I feel about stuff. Fireman's Fund has given us $8 or $9 million in the last 2 years for firefighter safety and survival equipment. They sponsored the national. They co-sponsored the National Near Miss Reporting System by matching the Fire Act grant. They co-sponsored the National Fallen Firefighter Everyone Goes Home program by matching the Fire Act grant, and now they spent money and put together, which I assure you is a kick-ass movie. You're going to love it. On the History Channel, Friday, October 13th, or again on October 22nd at 4 p.m. Set your DVRs, DVD player, whatever you have to record this thing. You want it. Trust me, you're going to really enjoy the movie. Danielle, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Chief.
Are you listening to Through Smoke? Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. We'll be right back with the rest of the show.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
Our breathing air, you know, we really kind of take it for granted, until you put your pack on and then you think, wow, did I check my pack today? Or when's the last time we did some practice with our SCBAs? And I had a fire just two nights ago, and it was a very, very nasty smoky basement fire. It was an arson job. It was due to a domestic. And we had three crews operating in the basement, and this smoke coming out was this nasty, thick, puffy, mustard-like smoke. And we did ventilation. We got three lines in service, and As we always preach to everybody, the goal is to get water on the fire as quick as possible, and our troops down at Loveland Sims Fire Department did that, and I was real proud of them. But thinking about the interview that we were going to do in the show this week, I started thinking about SCBAs and how often you check them, and really what kind of training do we go through, and it kind of ties into what my guests from Seattle are talking about. So there's a great program out there, and it's pretty much known as the Seattle Guys teaching the Firefighter Air Management Program. And my guest today is Captain Mike Galliano from Seattle, who partners with Captain Phil Josie, Captain Casey Phillips, and Lieutenant Steve Bernocco. And Steve must feel very intimidated, surrounded by all those captains. And I don't know if you get anything done with all those officers. Don't you have any firefighters working for you? Who does all the work, Mike?
We've actually brought on some assistants that are firefighters to get the work done.
So you guys can boss somebody around and do what you normally do in a firehouse, kick your feet up and read the paper, smoke a cigar type of a thing.
That's exactly right.
We
manage our air and we manage our assistants. So.
Excellent. Well, we're talking about firefighter air management program and our ability to survive. While packing up is a good start to lengthening our ability to keep responding to fire calls and maybe even be around long enough to have grandchildren, knowing how to manage your air and those of your firefighters carries it to a whole nother level. Now, this episode, Through the Smoke, is going to have some great discussion with Mike. We couldn't get everybody on the show, so Mike is representing Phil, Casey, and Steve, and those subordinate, hardworking firefighters that they have working in their program. And we're going to be talking about the rules of air management and how we're dying in structures. We're going to talk about the point of no return, the changes that are coming next year to the NFPA 1404 SCBA standard, and some critical understanding of smoke and cyanide. So really, this show fits into anybody that responds to fires, from chief to pro. Again, Mike, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much.
Well, what's this all about? What are you doing? Where'd this come from? What made you start thinking about managing air? I mean, for me, for years and years, I put the air pack on. I have a 30-minute pack. I know I'll last about 20 minutes, and when the bell starts ringing, I leave.
Well, we ask that question. Every time we teach a class, we open with that, and we say, how many of you, in the course of your careers as firefighters, that can span from a few days to many, many moons for most folks, how many times have you checked your air when you're committed to an interior structure fire or any interior that has a hazardous atmosphere? Unless you're brand new to the fire service, particularly in Seattle, where we train on this from the get-go, no one checks their air until their low air warning alarm activates. That's just standard SOP, and we're pretty honest and straightforward when we talk about our history. I know prior to beginning the research on this, in 16-plus years in the Air Force and in Seattle at that time, I do not recall checking my air one time until the bell hit.
I know I never. And when the bell hits, then it's time to go.
There's been a few folks that have said that, yeah, they've checked it here or there, but most of us can honestly say that checking the level of our air is something that we just don't do. We rely on that bell to hit, and then, contrary to what most folks will say, that's when we start to think about exiting.
Most folks don't necessarily even leave.
Yeah, we exit when the bell hits, and then they'll follow up with, is that true? Or is that just when you start to think to exit? We experienced some close calls in Seattle that really shook us up. We had three separate incidents right on the heels of the Brett Tarver incident. And
in different size structures.
What's that?
In Phoenix.
Yeah, the Brett Tarver incident in Phoenix, a Southwest supermarket fire. In Seattle, we had three incidences, and the thing that was interesting is we researched them, very different structures. One was a big, enormous ship, which is always a nightmare. We had a multi-occupancy type fire with apartments and residences above some businesses. And then we had just a simple old house fire. And in all three of those incidences, we came very close to having another firefighter fatality. All of these involving veteran officers and firefighters who knew what they were doing, had been to multiple fires, and each one of them in a different way almost lost their life due to running out of air.
Let's look at the house fire, because acknowledging that some of our audience may go to a ship fire, some of our audience may go to a commercial fire, but all of our audience is going to go to a house fire. What happened to that fire?
Well, see, that's a tremendous point, because we talk about the big buildings, and that's where everybody's kind of hackles raise up, and that's where they get chills in their spine, because they know that big entry time, same thing with ships, same thing with big apartment structures. Unfortunately, what has happened with managing our air is we've developed bad practices with SCBAs from the get-go, and that began when they first were put on the rigs. And as you well know, as a veteran of the fire service, when SCBAs were put on the rig, most people didn't use them. And it was
only when it was an emergency. We had them in boxes, actually, on a 58 Ward LaFrance heavy rescue. They were on boxes. We pulled them out when needed. But our officer had what we called a 15-minute pack, which has now become known as a suicide pack. If you remember those old sling packs, the bottle was about the size of my arm, and it was just enough to get you in trouble.
Yeah, and that's a tremendous way to put it, just enough to get us in, to get us in trouble. And so, yeah, we've begun with bad practices with the SCBA from the get-go, and it was viewed as being you were less of a firefighter if you used your mask. I think we can look back and give those firefighters a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, because it wasn't clear what was in the smoke at that time. Well, we know now, at least we should, if we're paying attention, we know now what's in the smoke. And we look at house fires, and that's kind of how we've developed our way of managing air, because with house fires, typically we know the ways out, we know where the exits are.
And it's our most common structure fire.
Sure is. We're going to those all the time. That's our bread and butter. And folks will always tell us, well, we always know where we are in a house fire. We always know where the exits are. We know we can get out of windows. We can follow hose lines out. There's other firefighters close at hand. The only question I would submit to folks who are making that claim is that why then is that where we're killing the majority of our firefighters? We always know our way out. If we can all make our way to an exit or through a window or a secondary means of egress, why are firefighters dying in structures, in house fires in particular? That's the question that needs to be answered,
right.
I think, for the people who are making the decisions. In our case, this was just a typical little two-story house. It was had a basement. It was like a lot of homes on Seattle. It was on a grade, so it was a difficult access to it.
Where was the fire?
The fire was in the basement, you know,
okay, basement
always a red flag.
Yep.
So, you know, aggressive primary search on the first floor resulted in one of the officers having, unclear to this point, a malfunction of the SCBA or something along those lines, whatever was the ultimate cause, ran out of air. And the upside of that is a veteran officer with more than 20 years in the fire service came out of that structure dead. Came out cyanotic, dead, not breathing, and fortunately, due to the excellent EMS program we have in the city of Seattle, revised and was brought back, and is on the job today. But
well, now you know. Let me pause you for a second. So you know, we think that, and your point is well taken. I can pretty much, based upon what neighborhood I'm responding to, tell you the kind of house I'm responding to, and in about 10 seconds, tell you where the entrances are, the exits, and pretty much how we're going to get out. But then something happens inside, and I think that's a critical difference. We arrive very confident, so as we're going in, we're confident, we're fine, we're okay. But then something happens inside, whether it's panic, whether it's smoke inhalation, which now we'll talk about later, which kind of totally eliminates our ability to remember any of the above, remember our training, remember any of that, and we're rendered unconscious.
That's exactly right. A thing we've all had close calls. One of the things that we talk about at length is close calls are simply tremors before the earthquake and before our hearts get broken. And you know, your awesome site, which is leading the nation in information for firefighters that's actually usable, details these time and time again. And you would probably say that we're only hearing about a fraction of the close calls that are happening across the country. As we teach our class, we say all the time, while we're going through this, a close call is happening somewhere in the United States. Firefighters are running out of air. We hope at the end of the class we're not hearing about another firefighter fatality.
We're getting about five to eight close calls a day in 24 hours, which is just a fraction exactly of what's going on. I mean, every one of us, almost every call we have a close call, whether it be minor or major.
And we always ask the students, how many of you have had close calls? The majority of them will raise their hands. Some of the newer folks don't, with us getting some less fires. And then we'll say, how many of you, did those get out to the country? Did people learn from that mistake? And they'll be very honest, as I would with the close calls that I've had. They don't get out because we don't talk about them, whether through embarrassment or just no means to get it out there. The only people that know about the close call usually are the folks that were directly involved. And there's some ribbing about it. Maybe you buy ice cream for the company. And that's where it ends. But the close calls are happening, and they're happening in environments that have gotten increasingly more dangerous. And I suppose we'll talk about how construction has changed in smoke along the lines. But as we began this, we became startled as we researched line-of-duty deaths, that a recurring theme continued to pop up, and it was in line-of-duty deaths, running out of air played, if not the primary contributing factor to the death, it was a source that caused them to either die of burns or die of heart attack, die in the structural collapse. And we felt like it was time to evaluate how we were utilizing our air and if there was something we could do, change some behavior that would allow us to not have as many line-of-duty deaths. We're not naive enough to think that we're going to eliminate them all. I mean, we are in a dynamic, ever-changing, dangerous profession.
Right, right.
But I feel like we can get after a bunch of them, and that's what we're committed to do, and we believe very firmly that it centers on how you use your air. There's tremendous amount of talk about changing the culture of the fire department. We're not really big advocates of that because we think the culture of the fire department is what makes us strong. We think the aggressive, citizen-oriented, brotherhood and sisterhood nature of the culture of the fire department, that's our bread and butter. But what we can do within that gung-ho, get-the-job-done culture is change some behaviors, and that's what we're about, and that's what our program centers on.
That's interesting. I kind of preach the same thing. You still have a ball being a firefighter and love what we do. And if we love being firefighters so much, why do so much stupid crap, get yourselves hurt or killed, can't be a firefighter anymore? So that there's opportunities to work a little bit smarter, but still have a ball going in, getting it, come back, you know, feeling like you did your job good without ending up in the hospital the rest of your life or getting yourself... Well, go ahead.
Well, you know, I think the citizens of most cities in the United States, there may be some exceptions, but I think they fully realize that when you look across the United States, when there's a problem, when you as a citizen, as a business, whatever, when you're having the worst day of your life,
right.
The single most effective and efficient answer to that problem is the well-trained fire company. And across the country, fire companies are making a difference in the lives of people. What we need to do as firefighters is continue to make that difference, continue to do the job that we're doing, and also take a look around us at our brothers and sisters who are also responding with us and make them, put them to the level of importance that they need to be at.
Now, what are you, let's get down to something that our listeners can use when they're done with this show. Give me some of the basics. What are you talking to your students about? Give me a couple of the basic tools so these folks can maybe this afternoon, after they're done listening to the show, have a run and use it. And I know it doesn't equate to attending one of your classes at a fire school, but give them something they can use. What are a couple of tips? And let's talk about the smoke itself. Let's talk about the cyanide issue, because that, I'll tell you, we've known about that. You know, it's kind of like really what you said before. We know the air pack's going to run out, but we don't worry about it till the bell rings. We know smoke has cyanide in it. We just didn't talk about it for a while. Now we're talking about it again, thanks to people like you, and unfortunately, due to the incident that happened up in Providence, Rhode Island.
Well, the nice thing about the research that we've done, I think chief officers and folks who have to spend the money will breathe a sigh of relief. You don't have to spend a lot of money to implement the research that we've done. In fact, you really don't have to spend any. You can implement what we're doing at a pretty large level just by listening to this show. What we found is firefighters are running out of air, and that's causing a host of problems within the IDLH atmosphere. I'll expand on the smoke a little later. But running out of air causes a multitude of problems before something bad goes wrong. Running out of air is bad in and of itself. You combine right. Running out of air with any other problem on the fire ground, and you're now getting very close to a firefighter fatality. At a minimum...
Give an example of that. What are you talking about? Run out of air is a problem in itself. What else?
Well, here's what we suggest as a solution to the problem of running out of air. But let me follow up.
That's
on
fine.
That.
Sure.
By running out of air, you've now put yourself in a position where you're part of the problem. You're running out of air causes you now to have to make some kind of exit if you're able to do that. You combine that with getting lost, you've got a really big problem in your hands because now you don't know where you're at. You have to make an egress. You've already worked into your emergency reserve, so that's causing you to have even less time not only to find your way out, but if you need some type of intervention, you've given the folks who are coming on the rapid intervention team literally no time to get to you. Throw a structural collapse in there. You're on the first floor and you're fighting a rock and fire. You've worked into your emergency reserve. Now, depending upon the workload that you've had, you've got, 1 to 3 minutes, possibly, depending on your bottle size, might be 5 minutes if you're working hard. You've got 1 to 5 minutes, and now you're collapsed. Now you're in the basement. Now you're hunkered down and you can't get out. You've activated RIT response. How long does it take our RIT teams to spool up to get in to get you, to even provide the assistance that you need?
Well,
That's the problem. Running
let's talk
out
about
there,
that for a second, too. You know, the whole RIT team idea, I'm a big fan of them. We use them here. But, you know, depending upon what companies respond, is the level of RIT service you're going to get. There's no guarantee of who that RIT team might be or what their training is, especially if you're relying on a mutual aid department. So while RIT teams are important, they may or may not work. So it ties right back to what you're talking about now.
Sure. I think we all can just think about situations that we've been in. If you get in a no-air situation in a toxic smoke environment, you're looking at rapid asphyxiation. If you are in a no-air situation, there's a thermal insult event, a burn event going on. Particularly if you pull your face piece, you're looking at burns to your throat and lungs, and we saw some of that detailed in that To Hell and Back series that they showed, where they went through the burns with the firefighters. I mean, the one guy had one puff of superheated air, and he was on a respirator for 7 days. And that was one. He got out. He got lucky. You throw in no air to structural collapse. How much time in a no air environment does a rapid intervention team have to spool up to get you? You get lost. You get separated. You start to breathe in the poisonous air, the poisonous and superheated air. Folks, running out of air for you chief officers who are making decisions, running out of air is probably the single most critical factor that firefighters can face on the fire ground today that we're not really addressing. We're addressing a host of items in trying to protect firefighter safety. This is not just being done in a vacuum. If you follow the Firefighter Close Calls website at any length at all, you'll see constant discussion about how to be safer when we're responding to accidents, which is where a lot of our firefighters are dying, just responding to accidents. And you'll see lots of information about wellness fitness to try to make some impact on firefighters that are dying of heart attacks. When you come to structure fires, the single biggest factor affecting deaths in firefighters is running out of air, asphyxiation, exposure to toxic components of smoke, and the long-term ramifications of that, which I hope we'll talk about a little bit down the road here. Don't think that just because you're not killing your firefighters at the structure fire, you're not killing them down the road 10, 20, 30 years. And
right.
It's not a pretty death. The firefighters are dying in hospitals due to the increased rates of cancer, the increased rates of life-threatening respiratory diseases, and again, something I hope we'll talk about a little bit later in the show, understand there's going to be no help, for the most part, from the folks who employed you. The cities generally are going to turn a blind eye.
We see it all the time. We see it all the time. Employers backing away from their employees who get disabled and injured. They say, oh, workers' comp will cover you, and you're screwed if you're relying on workers' comp.
Yeah, it comes down to a very simple concept, and I'll give you our key concept, but the thing that we try to get across to firefighters, whatever degree you buy into our air management ideas, the thing that firefighters need to recognize, the air on their backs is their lifeblood inside the structure. It has to be managed just like we manage every other resource on the fire ground. We manage the amount of personnel we come in through ICS. We manage our water. I mean, would you ever, as an apparatus operator, not pay attention to the level of water you have or the supply that you have in your tank? We manage equipment, how much we have on the roof in regards to saws and the ability to do good ventilation. We manage our ventilation efforts. Across the board, we pay attention to the operations we're doing, and we manage the resources. The one thing that we've been negligent in and don't really even think about a lot is probably of the utmost significance, because that's what allows us to stay alive in the toxic and IDLH atmosphere. Our solution, it's simple. You said it'd be better if you came to our classes, and I agree, but we're not in this to make a bunch of money. We're in this to get out of business as quick as we can. Our concept is the rule of air management. It's very simple. We call it Rome, and that's how I'll refer to it, but it's the rule of air management. If you implement it in your fire ground operations, you will go a long way towards eliminating the majority of the issues that cause firefighter deaths in structures. It's that simple, and we have research to back it up. The rule of air management, it's very simple. Know how much air you have in your SCBA and manage that air so you leave the hazardous environment before your low air warning alarm activates. In straight firefighter language, it's know how much you got before you go in, manage that air as you go, and leave before your bell hits. Your bell signifies that you're at the last 25% of your bottle. Whatever size bottle you use, that last 25% is known as the emergency reserve. The emergency reserve was never intended for the interior operation. It was like all of our SCBA practices early on, we began on a bad way. We either didn't wear them or we mocked people who did. Fortunately, in most cities across the nation, that now has become the era of the dinosaurs. Folks, the firefighters are required to wear their masks on interior operations. But we utilized that emergency reserve air for the interior operation, and it was never intended to be used. That the first three quarters of your bottle, and we're very adamant about this, whatever size cylinder you're using, the first three quarters is for the incident. That's for the citizens. That's for laying hose and ventilating and doing all the things that we do to try to take care of the worst day in the lives of most folks. The last 25% was intended for you. That's the firefighters there. In fact, one of our guys, Phil Jost, likes to say that that's mama's air. That's the air that gets me home to my family. That's the air that makes me not become a tragedy. We believe very strongly that if you are working at your low air bell, if you're utilizing your emergency reserve, you're making a very simple gamble. You're betting your life that nothing goes wrong on the out. Because if it does, you've violated that emergency reserve margin that was intended for you, and you are well behind the curve to surviving that incident.
What? All right, so I'm listening, and it's obviously I'm intrigued because I'm not talking while you are. I go to a house fire this afternoon, so I'm going to arrive. Basically, my attitude now, from based on what you just told me, I used to look at 100% being my entire body. Now I'm looking at 100% being the first three quarters, and that's the only air that I have, almost acting as if that's the only air I have to function and live on, with the 25% being my just-in-case air to get me back to mama. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
That's absolutely correct. And it you know, I think the fire service is the only industry utilizing air that deals with it the way we do, where 100% is meant for all the interior operation. If you look at the scuba industry, it's very defined. I mean, those folks don't mess around, and that's
the scuba divers
have,
you're talking about.
Yeah, scuba divers, sure. That's why they don't have as many incidents as we do, because they're very adamant about the fact that you get out of the water, you get up a boat with 500 psi left. You don't use that emergency reserve air down below in their ideal H atmosphere, water, and they're actually taking it so seriously that there's a move afoot in the dive industry to change that 500 psi to 1,000 psi.
A reserve
and,
for rescue.
Yeah, a reserve. And the reason's simple. I mean, when you look at it just practically, our lungs were not designed to breathe water. That's why that emergency reserve
right.
is left intact. Very, very simply, and we'll talk about the smoke, our lungs were not designed to breathe smoke, and we're reaping the repercussions of that as we go. We had a diver, very experienced diver in one of our classes. It was a great conversation. He made a comment that we had never heard before, and, you know, teaching this for a long time. He said, you know, now that I think about it, diving all these years as a scuba diver, I would rather run out of air as a scuba diver than I would as a firefighter. And we're like, why would that be? As an experienced scuba diver, he said, the one thing I know is I know which way's up. I know
yeah,
where to
right,
hit.
Right. Yeah, right, right.
As a firefighter,
and I was going to ask you about that, too. Let's do a little comparison. You go down to Bahamas or down to Florida, and you go scuba diving. Certainly there are some similarities, but you're going for pleasure. You're going to go look at a fish or, you know, what are you doing, or coral and stuff. If we're going into some, you know, piece of crap building or whatever the case may be, it's full of smoke. We are being tasked with emergency responsibilities. Get in there, do your search, get water on the fire. So there are, obviously, and you certainly know there are differences, and there's that, there's the increased rate of nervousness, the increased rate of pressure to hurry up, and now suddenly our bell rings. And my point is, I as a scuba diver could imagine, or I'm not, but if I were scuba diving, I can imagine that I would be much more conscientious about my air because I have less distractions. Now, I'm going in as a firefighter, and I buy into your theories. I go in as a firefighter now, and I've got all these other issues. I'm not going to look at coral and fish. I'm going to look for little Johnny or Janie. I'm going to pull ceilings. I'm watching for the fire. I'm feeling temperatures. What do I do to keep reminding myself to monitor my air and manage it? What do you teach? And it's almost like a human skill or a new habit you're going to have to teach. Is that correct?
Absolutely. When we talk to our students, we tell them quite honestly, having been in the fire service for about 20 years now in many different environments, and having not checked my air that I can remember one time in the first 16 years of that experience, we go to fires now. I still at times it's a so I have a couple of young guys on my crew. They've been trained this way from the get-go. They're reminding me, and I'm supposed to be the instructor of this skill. It requires training. It requires implementation at every level of the training, from recruit school on up. And in the Seattle Fire Department, we train on this in every drill evolution we go to. We talk about, in, as part of every interior operation, that the rule of air management will be followed, that you will exit with your emergency reserve intact. We see when we do a hands-on class, we do a hands-on 8-hour class where we bring firefighters of all different skills and experiences, different sizes of departments across the board. We bring them in, and the first thing we do is we get them into a good aggressive interior attack of some kind, just using basic skills like you enumerated at the outset of the program, to get them, to prompt them to check the air without us just having to load over and do it. We'll put little indicators, either glow sticks or some kind of indicator, and a certain indication along the way, they'll check their air. As we move through the day, we take those indicators out. By the end of the day, you're finding firefighters who have never checked their air, are routinely checking it, they're doing it quickly. You know, the first couple times you do it, it's a little clunky, because most guys, you'll find, run this test for chief officers and training officers and firefighters. Right. Run a test where you just have your firefighters check their air in a darkened environment. You're going to find that a chunk of them will not even be able to. They don't know how. They'll look at their gauge, and they either can't read it because they can't see, didn't glow enough, they don't know how to hit the backlight on their SCBA, or the most common thing is they're used to checking the SCBA when it's sitting upright in the mass compartment. Yeah, so they check.
I was just thinking the same thing. Yeah, I check mine in the trunk, and I'm done.
Yeah, and so a quarter, you know, you're looking at it, and you look at it, pop it up, and it's backwards because you're looking at it with it on your back, and you think you got three quarters, your bell's about to hit.
So that's where I'm going. This is so simple. It's a simple matter of training your people and disciplining yourself to just check your air. And I guess where I want to go, we're going to take a break in a second, but while I'm performing all these tasks, what you're saying is, that amongst that, I still have to maintain the discipline to keep checking that air. Now, with the newer air packs, some of them have the readout right in your mask and stuff. Obviously, your concept's going to be a little bit easier to follow. But I'm still interested in talking about the discipline with all they're having to do, especially in low staff areas where you're not only stretching the line, but you're opening up and you're searching as well. What do I need to do to train my people and train myself to keep remembering to check the air and know when to get out? So you're listening to RadioFirehouse.com. My guest this week is Captain Mike Galliano, who is developing some great training on firefighter air management out of Seattle. This is Through the Smoke. I'm Billy Goldfeder. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
We're back. This is RadioFirehouse.com. This is Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. I'm spending time talking with Captain Mike Galliano about firefighter air management, the rule of management. And before I go on, I want to also remind you of something else. I was talking earlier about fire grants and opportunities for fire departments to get free stuff. I got another one, and I added the link down at the bottom of your bottom of your screen there. You can check this out. But Michelin Tires has launched a Driving America Safety program that allows fire departments to win free tires for their apparatus. And while tires ain't cool, they sure do matter. I mean, it's not like winning a bell, I guess, or winning a new piece of apparatus. But tires are an expensive item for fire departments. And Michelin has stepped up to the plate, being a good corporate partner to us, and is allowing people in your community to nominate you or your department for a free set of tires, which, again, it's an expense that a lot of fire departments would rather avoid. You got to have your citizen send in a 300-word essay describing why a local firefighter, EMT, or medic should be chosen to win a new set of Michelin tires for any piece of apparatus in your department. So it could be your tower ladder, it could be your tanker, it could be a rescue, whatever you want. And they're going to be evaluating those and getting those nominations done soon. Basically, you have to the end of this month to get it in. Click the link at the bottom for more information on this very cool program that will allow you to win some tires or have somebody in your community nominate you to win some tires for your department. Clearly, every one of us gets letters of thanks and people visiting thanking you for a good job well done. And they say, well, what can I do for you? Well, now you can tell them, hey, check this out. Tell them that, you know, we appreciate what our fire department do. We'd like them to get some free tires, so check it out. Well, we're back. We're going to talk with Mike Galliano. Mike, let's get back into the discussion we're having about the discipline of remembering to check that gauge. Talk to me.
Well, it is a discipline. It's we believe it's the new basic firefighter skill. Your air that you bring into the structure, that's your lifeblood, and it's the running out of air and the resulting asphyxiation or other things that come from it is the primary reason firefighters are dying in structures today. So obviously, we feel like that ought to get our attention. If you're a decision maker in your department, I would hope that you care enough about your folks to at least listen, and I think if you look at the data, it's overwhelming.
So just like I'm going to keep looking, I'm going to look around in a room, I'm going to feel for heat, I'm going to touch the floor around me, I'm also going to do an SCBA check my gauge. In that list of things that I'm thinking about as I'm crawling through a room, you want me to remember to do this too. It becomes basically just one of the important tasks I must do while I'm operating inside.
Yeah, as we teach our classes, Billy, it's interesting. Towards the end, normally, there's usually resistance at the beginning, as you would imagine. Anything that is a change is normally resisted. At the end of the day, most of the students in our classes are responding with, this is so simple, why weren't we doing it before? And
right.
I realized that having been involved in many, many interior operations of many different kinds, there's a heck of a lot going on, and it's happening fast, and it's in an environment that isn't friendly. There are urgent issues at hand, from going and rescuing folks to just making the building tenable so it doesn't drop down on top of us.
Bad. Or the floor is spongy or whatever. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things going on. If you practice, if you make it a part of your routine training, the routine checking of your air becomes not much of a problem at all. We have some indicators that we like to give folks of when it's a good time to check your air, and obviously right at the beginning of the operation. But the first part of the rule of air management is know what you have in your bottle. A lot of folks don't even do that. And so you start out the operation with a less than full bottle, or you've maybe had a slow bleed from your check or a malfunction. You've gone into it with two strikes against you. You do go in with a full bottle. You do follow the rule of air management. At least you start with a foundation, and you have an idea of how long you can stay in there, depending upon your work rate and how far you're in and all the other factors that affect it. But some good times.
Okay, so that's step one.
Yeah, step
I'm
going
to take a look at my gauge. What are some of the other tips you said as you go along? What are some of the other things that they should...
Some of the other things you can do, you know, number one, psychologically, just recognize that, you know, it's your air, that's your lifeblood. If you can just psychologically get that into your head that it's important, that's a prompt for most people. On a physical level, we recommend a variety of things depending upon the structure and the environment you're in. After a significant workload is a great time to check your air. So you've just breached a wall, or you've just pulled a ceiling, you've just done a really aggressive, through lots of debris, search of a room, you go out of that room, that's a great time to check, because you could have gone into that room with, you know, whatever it is, a full bottle, two-thirds of a bottle, but now you've done a big workload or a heavier workload, and most firefighters will recognize that just from the normal trotting
the breathing,
around the room,
sure.
Where you can see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Check it after a workload, a change of levels. Anytime you're in a position of changing levels, number one, that's...
You're talking about floor levels. I've gone from
the
first
floor
to the basement.
Yeah, any level, whether
you're
going up,
okay.
Yeah, whether you're going up or whether you're going down,
okay.
That has a dramatic impact on your ability to egress that structure. That's a great time to check your air. And here's the thing that's interesting. It was something that we didn't realize and we didn't expect to come out of the training that we're doing. A lot of folks are talking about situational awareness being something that we've really got to do a better job of when we're inside structures. We have to recognize not only when conditions are getting better, but when they're getting worse. Not just doing the bull rush, forward at all costs, firefighting mentality where we just go, 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 without some cognition of what's happening around us, what's going on in the structure, what's going on with the smoke, the heat,
right.
All the various factors that we're faced with. What we found is the firefighters who are disciplining themselves through these little cues to check their air are also getting a little bit of a break in that action. And that break in the action is causing, in the drills that we've now done across the country, this is not a West Coast issue. We've done them across the country. It's a pause in the action, a break in the action, particularly for the team leader, who really can play a big role in ensuring that the error of their team is monitored and that it's recognized when they're low. It's a situational awareness brief. And so that little pause looking at the gauge also has been a cause in our drills for firefighters to stop and look around and say, you know, it's taken us, you know, a good half of our bottle through a pretty nasty environment to get where we are.
We haven't even reached the seat of the fire yet, for example.
Exactly, or even, you know, with building construction the way it is now, where the time temperature curve has shrunk, where they're getting hotter faster, where we're getting in deeper because of our excellent bunking gear, where the building materials are tighter, the compartments are tighter, and they're failing faster.
We're in a lightweight wood truss house or something like that. We know we have much more to. Yeah. Okay. So
yeah, we don't have the time. I mean, even on floors now with the DI beams, floors are failing faster in the newer construction. It's a pause and a break in the action, and it causes you to evaluate the situation. I came into this house fire. I had medium heat and I had low smoke. It was about 6 feet off the floor. Now all of a sudden, I'm into this thing, I'm doing my search, there's supposed to be inhalation happening. Now my moderate heat, it's getting hotter, I've got smoke about 2 feet off the floor. Something has changed and something's not going right in regards to ventilation. As a team leader, I'd be aware of that. The air checks we found have caused firefighters to think about it. As you practice it, as difficult as it may seem for folks who've never done it, and I hadn't one of those, you practice it over a series of drills, and then the fires that you go to on a routine basis, it becomes no different than turning on your bottle. It becomes no different than checking the door before you go in. It becomes a basic skill that in all drama...
Really no big deal. Yeah, really no big deal.
It'll save firefighters' lives.
So we get there. Before we get in, we take a look at our gauge, take 2 seconds to do that. It gives me a point to start. to gauge that 100% mark we talked about before. We grab the line, we work our way to the stairway. We work our way up to the second floor. When we get there, it's time to check it again. We get upstairs, and we've got heavy fire conditions, the truck's opening up, we're knocking the fire down, we got the bulk of the fire knocked down, it's time to check it again. Those are kind of the points you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Very easy, very routine process that with a little bit of practice comes into play. If you have time, I could give you the scenario you used is kind of interesting because one of the scenarios that we talk about was a typical bread and butter house fire in Fort Worth, Texas, and it's exactly the situation that you're talking about. Two-story wood frame house, veteran firefighter on the line with a fire company that has fought a lot of fire. They have a ripping fire on the second floor. They're fighting the fire, and the bell hits. What do? They don't have a backup line yet. What do they do?
We're
they
staying
keep
in
fire.
Here.
Yeah, they keep staying fighting fire. We're here. Not going anywhere. Keep fighting fire. Now that bell, that telltale bell, is starting to slow down, and it's starting to go tick, 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 and they're a few breaths away from needing to get out of there, and they make the decision to go. One of the firefighters turns around to leave, and his hand gets jammed in the back of the backpack apparatus of the officer. In pulling that out, and the glove getting stuck, and pulling that out, the firefighter told us he stepped away about 2 to 3 feet, did a turn, and in that span, prior to this, he had known where the exit was. There was a hand line leading down the stairs, no problem. In that span, with the low smoke conditions and the increasing heat, went to turn around and head out, hit a wall. That short amount of time, that little bit, he was disoriented. Now, there may be firefighters out there who haven't had experience in fires who go, oh, that's baloney. How could you get disoriented that quick? Those of us who've been fired know how you can get disoriented that quick.
Sure. And he's completely lost. He does not have that air to get him home to mama.
Well, now he's in trouble. He doesn't know where the exit
right.
is. The
it's
conditions
gone.
Are bad. Yeah. He's heading out. He goes the way he thinks he's supposed to go. And he missed the stairwell that was the exit to being safe. He missed it by 4 inches, the little wall that divided the stairwell from a room. It was that 4 inches, that little margin of air, that brought him into a bedroom, and he had to pull his face piece because he was out of air. He took one snort of that air, that nasty, toxic air, and knew he couldn't take another one. And the only option left to him at that time, there was one option left, and it was to dive out the second floor window. And there are pictures of this on the websites, Glenn Elman's site, Fort Worth, I believe it's fortworthfire.com, of the Bart Bradbury incident. And you'll see Bart going head first out the window. Fortunately, another firefighter got in the bedroom and grabbed his foot, and a couple guys caught him as he went down. But if you look at those pictures, it's a clear indication of what running out of air is. It eliminates your options. You're now down to usually one or two options. None of them are good. And Bart was a close call that in he'll tell you to this day, his three young kids very well shouldn't have had a father that day. And at a minimum, jumping, diving out a two-story window, there should have been the gravitational effects of severe injury.
We have a link here, too, that on the site that we're going to allow our listeners to go and check out those photos of these that you're talking about. Let's talk for a second about the point of no return. What's that all about? I mean, I know what I think it means. What do you think it means?
Sure. Well, the point of no return, you had mentioned earlier in the broadcast the point of no return and then talking about the NFPA 1404, and that's really where, at least for firefighter purposes, the point of no return originated from. The NFPA 1404 is a repertory standard. That's kind of the law for firefighters across the country. And for the most part, firefighters are following what's in the 1404. One of the key elements in regards to SCBA, there's a listing of elements that you're supposed to do, and most of us do those. Fit tests, I think most firefighters are doing those across the nation. Maintaining the SCBA, all of those. Well, there's two in there that routinely, when we talk about the 1404 to classes, there's two of them that we don't do, or at least that very rarely do we talk about, and I think most fire departments don't address them at all. And it's mandatory language in the 1404 respiratory standard. One of those, IDing the factors that affect the duration of air supply. So what's the stuff that's causing our bottles to deplete, both for the good and for the bad? And the second one is a determination of the point of no return. And that's where we got the concept of the point of no return and have put it into our classes and our teachings. Here's the problem with the point of no return, and I hope anyone who's listening this will really listen close and get this. The point of no return has very ominous overtones, and that's fine. You know, we want you to stand up and take notice. Most times when we ask people, what do you think of when you think of the point of no return, folks will say, we've gone too far, we're not coming back, that's the point at which you die. And the unfortunate imagery that instills is that is absolutely false. For firefighters, it's not the point at which you die. And we really try to make that clear because we don't want that psychological imagery in your head when you're in the middle of one of the worst situations of your life. For firefighters, it's never too late. You never stop. You never give up. I don't care how many mistakes you've made to get yourself in the position you're in. I don't care what the circumstances are. You do everything in your power to give us a chance to get in and get you. And I don't care what that means. If it means poking a hole in the wall and trying to pull a breath of air out of the wall, you do that. The problem with the imagery of the point of no return is we started to develop our program. Our brothers and sisters in law enforcement really went through this on their gun training. They would do gun training, and they would on the ranges. It was more important to collect their brass before they went on than to actually do the operation. And there was a classic case, an FBI case, where the bad guys were coming in a car, killing these FBI agents, and they found the guy's brass in his hand. He was collecting his brass in the middle of the firefight because that's the way they trained. So we want to make sure that as we train this, the point of no return is not the point at which you die. It's not the point at which you give up. So we spent a lot of time trying to get a definition that we felt like applied to firefighters as far as the point of no return goes.
Yeah.
What we've come up with...
Now you got me all interested and confused.
I got you set up, baby. That's the deal.
I spent most of my life interested and confused, so I'm comfortable.
Well, our definition of the point of no return, the way we teach it, it's the point at which you stop becoming part of the solution and you start becoming part of the problem. And this is particularly true as it pertains to air. It's a host of factors that cause you to become part of the problem. And, firefighters are aggressive, get-the-job-done people. The last thing you want is to not accomplish our task and to not get the job done. We don't want to be part of the problem. We're problem solvers. There's some things, some real key factors that we found, particularly as it relates to your air, that directly affect the point of no return and cause you to stop impacting the solution in a positive way. And it's all simple stuff. It's not rocket science. It's having the appropriate equipment and knowing how to use it. And that's true critically for your SCBA. Being prepared to fight the fire physically, mentally, emotionally, knowing your air supply as you're heading into the structure is a critical factor. The ongoing evaluation of your air, which we talked about, and then knowing the physical layout of the structure and monitoring that as you proceed. Those basic factors are critical, and they find their origin in the NFPA 1404, to not becoming part of the problem. And make no mistake about it, I don't want to be too dramatic, but the point of no return is trying to break your heart. From the moment you show up, you show up at the fire station, the point of no return and the factors that surround it, there are elements that are pulling you towards it, and it's trying to ruin your day. It's trying to get you to that firefighter funeral and bring you to your knees. And I know that you know, many of the brothers and sisters out there have had the agony of sitting through firefighter funerals, and of course we in Seattle, our most recent was the Pang Fire. And I can tell you from experience, sitting next to my brother, Rudy Terlicker, in recruit school, obviously if you'd have told me that one day I would be searching through the rubble for his dead body, obviously my response to you wouldn't have been good.
Right.
We are dealing with very real dangers, and we can't be cavalier about it, and we can no longer look to the rah-rah, this is the way I did it when I came in, I'm not going to change. We are dealing with not only the lives of our brothers and sisters, but the damage and the outcropping that flows out from that, not just for the firefighter family. You have people, Chief, that count on you. I mean, you've been, for the last week or so, you've been at your wife's side for her father's illness. You have people that count on you. As company officers, as chief officers, we have to recognize that our firefighters are every bit as important, and I would submit to you respectfully, they're of more importance than the job that we're going to do, and we've got to take it seriously. And that's what the point of no return is. You show up at the station, there are factors that are pulling you towards it. And a few of those, not anything, again, that's any great rocket science. We're not rocket scientists. These Seattle guys aren't rocket scientists. But you stay in the hazard area until your bell rings. That's a key factor. You get locked in on tunnel vision, which the checking of your air will help to eliminate. You're being pulled towards point of no return. You bring a blustery ego to the fire ground where I'm going to get the job done no matter if it kills me. I'm going to work through my air. If I don't have air, I'm going to keep doing the job. You are well on your way to not only hurting yourself, but maybe hurting or killing the team that you're with and the folks that are probably going to try to come in to get you. You're putting them at risk as well. Poor command structure is a big one. Lack of RIT training and ability and capacity.
Sure, all these little factors.
Yeah, not training in the basics. We have gotten away some RUT from training in the basics. We're training a lot on into the world stuff and W&Ds and all the different.
Yep, absolutely, sure.
Yeah, we're doing all that training. We have to focus on the basics. But that, in a nutshell, okay. There's a lot more to it. But that, in a nutshell, is the point of no return. And the NFPA 1404.
Let me jump back for point of no return for a second before we go to 1404. A good friend of mine, Mark Wessel, fire chief of Keokuk, Iowa. Mark lost 3 kids and 3 firefighters in a dwelling fire a couple years ago. Tragic, tragic fire. And Mark has a great quote. He says, the goal of the fire department is to respond and help people with their problem, not becoming part of the problem. And that's exactly what you just keyed in on, is the point of no return. One of the factors in that is now you've become part of the problem if
exactly.
You fail to manage your air. Cool. Good.
Exactly.
1404, what's coming up with that? Anything?
Yeah, well, the 1404, once again, that's the law of the land for you chief officers out there. When firefighter fatalities happen, it's when you appear in the the courtrooms across America, and it's happening more and more, that's the standard that's going to be referenced, and it's going to be referenced as to how you're doing in regards to that standard in your air management practices. I already detailed some of what the current 1404 says.
Okay, so what you've been talking about is all part of what's coming up.
That's all existing, correct. Well, as a result of attending our classes early on a few years ago, a couple members of the 1404 committee came and took our class, and they went back and they made some suggestions of changes to the current 1404 standard to make it safer for firefighters. And I have to commend them because it's naughty stuff. It's difficult to get change in the fire service. The changes that they recommended in the upcoming 1404, again, going back, this is over a couple-year process.
And now these changes, what you're going to list now, are going to be their official now, right?
That's correct. Yeah, they initially took these recommendations back. I believe it was there were 4 abstentions. It was like 18-4 to put the program. It went out to the fire service for
the whole
discussion.
Review process and all.
Yep.
Okay, so what are they?
Well, the one changes that are coming as of January 1, 2007, is that an air management program within your jurisdiction is mandatory. It's mandatory.
No kidding.
You
wow.
You will have an air management program.
Uh-huh.
In the index, it now lists what should be key elements of that program, and there are three elements that we feel like you really need to key on because it is a change in behavior for the majority of the firefighters across the country. Number one is that you will exit before you use your reserve air. In essence, you will follow the rule of air management. You cannot violate that emergency reserve. Activation of that emergency reserve, basically you're going off in the structure, that's an indication of the use of reserve air. Number three, that then becomes an immediate action item. Now, the wording of that, folks say, so what do you mean? I call a mayday for every bell that goes off? That's not what the wording says. What it says, it's an immediate action item. That firefighter whose bell is going off needs to be checked. Are you okay? Are you exiting? If we had done that in the close call that we had in Seattle, they would not have been close calls because those firefighters would have been exited out of the structure. In the case of the ship fire that I mentioned earlier, firefighter McDougall, that cat was in trouble. I mean, he was disoriented in a nasty rockin' ship fire. It's the hottest fire I've ever been in my career. It was a dangerous mess. His bell was ringing. Firefighters were walking past him because it's a routine thing. You know, it's a false alarm mentality. Bells are going off all the time.
Sure.
He ran out of air. He was disoriented. And he just, fortunately, a firefighter recognized that he was out of air and about to be overcome and took him out of the ship. What we have to eliminate, and I commend the 1404 committee, they had the guts to stand up and make change to stop something that's killing us. We have to stop falling into the false alarm mentality with our alarm bells going off. If we will treat those as an immediate action item, number one, they'll become rare. That's our goal. We want that bell going off in the IDLH to be a rare occurrence. You just happen to work through, and now it's time to exit. We want that to be a rare occurrence. If we can make that happen, and just a note, you know how committees are. They're rarely unanimous about anything.
Right.
The NFPA 1404 committee looked at this with so much diligence, and these are firefighters and people from across
sure.
the country.
Right.
This is East and West. They passed it unanimously, and as of January 1, that will be the new standard for respiratory protection and for air management.
That's a pretty exciting change. Are we going to see any physical changes required on SCBAs that match this 1404 changes?
At this point, there's no real the technology is getting better, which is great. We're going through some changes in bottles right now, just in our past devices and how we're being notified of our air. We now have the heads up displays that I
sure.
think are going to be that'll be a big assist for some folks. I have a still difficult time with the heads up display just seeing it, but that's a training issue. Here's the thing with technology. If you can give me a second, just on technology.
Well, we have a few seconds left, and I definitely want to talk about the smoke and cyanide, so go ahead. What you have to do now is manage your air, your radio air time. So go.
Well, our supposition is with technology, the problem with any technology, no matter what it is, whether it's inside or out, is it is subject to failure. And unfortunately for us, if it fails, it's probably the worst time. We're banking on the firefighter's brain. We'll take the firefighter and the firefighter's training over any piece of technology you can throw at us. And that's what managing your air is all about. At the base company level, whatever else happens at the strategic level, whatever else happens in command with gadgets that they put on us to manage our air, the ultimate responsibility for the firefighter is that your air is your responsibility. We have to learn to manage it better.
Okay, good. So although the new technology is cool, I'm agreeing with you, and I'm not sure I would have agreed before we talked about this, so that's great. I just don't think this is going to be all that difficult. I think what you shared with us on this show about your reminder points is critical. And I think just from what we talked about, I don't think I'll have any trouble reminding them or remembering to do those. Getting off the truck or getting out of the car, checking it, getting in the front door, checking it, performing a test, checking it, up or down the stairs, checking it, moving to another room, checking it, things like that. So I think just that in alone, you're going to make a big difference, in at least through this show. Now, let's talk about smoke and cyanide. And I know there's a lot to talk about on this whole subject. We're just limited on how much airtime we have. And maybe we'll bring you back on for part two. This is a fascinating subject, and I'm sure our listeners are going to love it. Let's talk about smoke and cyanide. So many folks were shocked when the Providence situation went down. And I got to tell you a quick story is, and we had gone through the smoke. They're in a back issue here that's available here on the website. I had Kurt Verone, Deputy Chief of Providence, and on, and we talked about this. And Kurt called me the morning after that happened. And we were digging and digging, thinking, why would there be cyanide? Why? We called who I consider one of the nation's hazmat experts, John Eversole, right out of Chicago. And we're pulling our hair out, and suddenly, duh, cyanide's in the smoke. Yeah, exactly. Like, we learned that 30 years ago. We just didn't think much about it. You know, we went breathing all this crap. And when you talk about cyanide and smoke, and you remind firefighters that cyanide's the same stuff they kill the bad guys with when they're in prison and they get a death sentence, kind of takes on a different meaning. Talk to us about what it means to you.
Well, you know, I want to give a word of encouragement and congratulations to Providence. Those folks didn't cover up. They didn't hunker down and just say,
right,
you know,
we don't want to
talk about it. Yeah, they were honorable about it, and they're getting it out there. It's much like Phoenix Fire, who, when they have something, they try to let the fire service learn from their mistakes. So my hat's off to them, and the great news is the firefighter who suffered a heart attack survived and doing well, still having some implications from what occurred, but is alive and with his family, and so that's a great thing. We should know by now that it should not come as a surprise to any sober firefighter that the smoke is a nasty...
That's a whole other subject.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? You know, like you said, we could do another show.
Sure. But a conscious firefighter, sure.
Yeah, it's a nasty, toxic mess. If you're fooling yourself that it's not a deadly environment to be in, that's a whole other issue. There is hydrogen ionide in every fire you go to today. There may be folks that quibble with that. I was reading, it was interesting, I was reading the little write-up that they did on the Providence fires, and it was three different fires. It was the stuff you go to every day. It was a little restaurant fire, it was a three-story frame apartment building, and it was a house fire. I think all of us go to those fires on a routine basis. And when they talked about it, they said that there was cyanide present in all the fires. Some of the things that were burning were crib mattress, plastic bags of clothing, plastic toys, electronic devices, box springs, carpeting with foam padding underneath. That's stuff that's in every fire we go to. So the notion that somehow the stuff that's going to be burning at your fire is going to be benign is foolish. You're going to have CO at your fires. You're going to have hydrogen cyanide at your fires. You're going to have at every fire you go to carcinogenic agents from, I mean, the list is, you can do the research yourself, but the list goes on and on. It's benzene, it's hydrogen chloride, it's phosgenes, PAHs, it's dioxin. Yeah, stuff that is absolutely going to wreck your firefighters' lives. Cyanide, which is now kind of coming to the forefront, is interesting because it mirrors carbon monoxide in a lot of the ways that we present. Not get into the science too much, but it's a hitotoxin. It causes the mechanisms of the cell that allow them to use oxygen to be deactivated. Similar to CO, it binds with the hemoglobin. So the oxygen that you're breathing in is inhibited from getting to your cells. Your cells don't get the oxygen, and particularly as it pertains to your organs, like your brain and your heart, you start to have cellular damage. You start to have breakdown. How that presents itself at the very end, obviously, is death, but it's the stuff that happens in between there that we really need to stand up and take notice. The one significant difference, or at least it's pretty significant from CO exposure, is hydrogen cyanide causes an excitement, an anxiety, and what we believe and what we think research is going to really show is that's what's causing some of the bizarre behavior we see when people get exposed to smoke. And classic example is Brett Tarver.
I was just
Southwest
thinking the
supermarket
same thing.
Fire.
Yep.
Yeah, they had them. I mean, it's heartrending to listen to the reports, and you know, if you listen to Chief Brunicini, who's absolutely changed the fire service with his the way he's approached things, they had him, and he fought him off. He was a big, strong guy, and inside that, you know, that doggone death trap, he fought him off. He ran away from him, and it's that bizarre behavior that we believe is directly related to cyanide exposure. It's 35 times, you know, approximately 35 is more toxic than the CO. It gets in there and it stops your body processes from doing what they're supposed to do. Now, of extreme significance with this, and this happened in the Providence fire, we're not going to be able to quantify it absolutely, but it certainly is worth talking about. Because it causes that oxygen deprivation to the organs, it also causes heart arrhythmias. And you can look at the descriptions in some of the articles that have been written. Every arrhythmia that you can't pronounce it causes.
Right.
There was a heart attack that occurred in the Providence fire that caused all this stuff to happen. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't even have recognized it. It would have probably been just another close call or another line-of-duty death that went unnoticed. Because they had that heart attack, because in three separate fires they were showing these symptoms, they tested the guys. He could have had that heart attack and died in that fire, and it just would have been the typical heart attack in a fire caused by stress.
Right.
That's right. It would have never been addressed that the hydrogen cyanide, of which he had critically elevated levels, could have been and probably was directly related to the heart attack.
And it was almost a fluke they found that. In talking to Chief Verone, he said if it weren't for a young, gung-ho trauma surgeon in the trauma center that night who ordered these normally unusual tests, they wouldn't have even found that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the thing with hydrogen cyanide that is so deadly, there's a book that I hope you'll recommend to your readers. I know your good friend and mine, Bobby Halton, turned me on to. He said it's the single most important book that firefighters have never read. And it's called In the Mouth of the Dragon. It's Toxic Fires in the Age of Plastics. And it's written by Deborah Wallace. And it details
New York,
what
I think, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And
I
would recommend all firefighters to grab a copy of that book. It details some of the New York telephone fire.
Telephone company fire, right.
Yep.
Of which there are no more surviving firefighters, correct?
No, there are. There are some folks that are surviving, but if you talk to some of the brothers who were involved, there's nobody on the first alarm who didn't come out of that thing with implications.
That's right. No, right. That has not drastically had their life impacted from that fire. Yeah.
That's exactly correct. The problem with the hydrogen cyanide is that it starts before you actually have big fire rolling. It's exacerbated by that. But in particular, like the Rhode Island fire, they have pretty clearly in the reenactment of that through NIST have determined that at an early stage of that fire there were toxic levels of hydrogen cyanide. One of the key contributors to that is flooring, carpeting. And that's where our good air is supposed to be. You know, get down, kid, and suck the carpet. We get teased about that all the time. You'll see us coming and knock down on the floor and air management, you know, just joshing us about it. Well,
right.
as the building heats up, as the compartment heats up, that carpet and all those plastics and synthetics.
It's off-gassing.
It's off-gas. That's exactly
yeah.
right, brother. It's off-gassing
yeah.
the hydrogen cyanide. And down there where the clean air is supposed to be is where we're getting exposed to this. And that's not always going to kill us, and obviously it doesn't because we're surviving these incidents. But what you're doing is you're allowing toxic levels of a known agent that will cause narcotic effects. It'll cause you not to think clearly in an environment where we need to be thinking as clearly as we ever have. And that's what causes some of this behavior we see and maybe some of the decisions that lead to injuries and line of duty. It's something that has to be addressed and has to be taken seriously. You can do it 100 different ways. You can address the hydrogen cyanide, the CO, and the smoke 100 different ways. The one thing that you can do tonight without adding another body on your rig, without buying another piece of equipment, without doing any massive training program, the one thing you can do is adopt the rule of air management. If you'll manage your air and leave with your reserve intact, you'll not only eliminate the majority of the close calls that are happening inside structures, when something bad does happen, like a collapse, you're giving yourself a shot to be rescued.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating stuff we talked about today. And honestly, to the firefighters that are listening, that fully comprehend, and maybe those who don't, to those who don't, what we're saying is, if you're breathing a little bit of smoke in the buildings you're going in today and you think it's okay, at the point where it's not okay, you won't know it's not okay. And that starts that process we've been talking about. And that's why officers and chiefs, company officers and chief officers, you got to be a boss. Zero tolerance on no SCBAs. This fire we had the other night, one of our captains, one of our best captains, Captain Mark Rose, who was the battalion working that night, as we overhaul, he saw a firefighter not wearing his mask. He jumped all over him. That's a big cultural change indicator for me when I see that happening. We see it happening more and more. Well, Mike Galliano, what a great discussion you had. Perhaps we'll have you on in the future. And I know that you're speaking also for Phil and Casey and Steve on the program you guys are doing, the air management guys from Seattle. Again, Mike, thanks for your time today.
Brother, thanks for the opportunity, and I would direct you to one other place, the Cyanide Poisoning Treatment Coalition. has a wonderful site. We just partnered with them with the smoke insert that I believe you're going to put on your website. It's a great avenue with our website and the other multiple.
We can link it through your website, ManagerAir.com?
Link it through ours, yeah, and then I can shoot I can shoot it to you to put on yours.
Well, we'll check it out, and we're going to have that link. It is on here now. The listeners, look down. I've provided a number of links for you to check this out. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. Thank you for listening. The show is Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder, producer, Pete Matthews and Matt Evans. We'll see you soon. Be careful.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.